The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
We got a real simple plan. One man, one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven. This might be college football heaven.
This is ESPN's College Game Day podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel, here's Reese Davis.
Fight, fight, green and white. I don't think that's what they mean. Who does Michigan State want to be? And putting the two into Tui Maloau, and what do you do on a side trip to Hattiesburg? This is College Game Day podcast for Halloween 2022. Reese Davis and Pete Thamel here. We'll get to the Michigan State fight in the tunnel, and JT Tui Maloau was that was as great an individual defensive performance as you'll ever see against Penn State. But Pete, it's Halloween. You've got young Teddy there. Is young Teddy dressing up for Halloween tonight?
So young Teddy has multiple costumes. I would say this, you know, throughout many of the first months of his life, young Teddy's adorable. And we joked that he was really just a prop for Instagram because he would he would get put in a bunch of just different outlandish outfits. And that, you know, he'd be put out to the masses for the likes and the hearts. And Teddy gets plenty of them. So he has two different costumes right now that his aunt got him. One is a dinosaur of some sort. And I will say this, probably his best Halloween moment is he has Elmo Halloween themed pajamas that I don't know if we can wear in November. So, cause he's a big Elmo fan. So, yeah, he's rolling into 8 months. Elmo, I was told Elmo might make an appearance at his first birthday party. So,
wow.
Yeah, you may even hear him screaming in the background today. Cause Teddy's rolling around, Teddy's rolling around the old condo in Boston this morning. So, yes. So we're not going to hit the streets with young Teddy yet, basically because it conflicts with his bedtime. But yeah, there'll be some we'll drop a little Teddy dressed up goodness on the pod group text for everybody to see. So,
yeah, I would like to see that. Maybe you ought to put it out on Instagram, too. I don't know. You have to decide what you want to do with your kids. I remember that we had when they were young, like Teddy, before they turned one. I think we had 1 year a Pooh Bear costume and then maybe a pumpkin. Maybe one of my kids was a pumpkin. I have to look at the pictures to remember which was which, but fun times, man. Well, the best thing is that when they're really young and you can actually take them out and go trick or treating, well, they're too young to have all of that candy. Of course you can't have that. So, and you don't want it to go to waste. So therefore you get some free candy out of the deal.
Is it bad that I'm not a big sweets guy?
Well, no, it's probably good for you, but I will say that I can't understand it.
Okay, that's fair. No, I know you're a sweets guy.
I love it.
Not like Desmond Howard. My God, Desmond Howard loves sweets. He is a bird dog for the best sweets in the cities we go to. He is impressive with his consistency. And he also still looks like he could go run a 4.3. So
yeah, he works it off so that he can do it. And I think Desmond is great at moderation, portion control on that. But, you know, one of his twin boys loves cookies. The other one loves cinnamon rolls. It's easy to get cookies. And he had a big tray of cinnamon rolls that he was taking back. I've forgotten. I think it's little twin. He calls big twin and little twin. I think it's little twin that likes the sweet rolls. He said he was going to be surprised by the cinnamon rolls. And
yeah, there's plenty of good food in Jackson last week.
I was sorry. I got there a little bit late. Due to my wife's birthday, but the catering was tremendous that we had from a local establishment. And I even, Pete, because, you know, Friday nights, usually I just lock in the room. I even ordered room service and had some spectacular gumbo. So
really?
Great food. Room did you find it? Wow. Did you find anything in the side trip to Hattiesburg, either food wise or football wise of note?
So I went pretty direct to the Rock right from the airport when I landed in Jackson. So I did not. I have been to an elite barbecue place in Hattiesburg. I went there, Will Hall's first spring, and Brent Jones, the Troy AD who had worked there, insisted I go to this hole in the wall for ribs, which, of course, you'd think I'd remember the name of, but I don't. We'll get it for the next show. Hattiesburg is a good eating town. The Rock was jumping the other night. That was a fun football game. I will say that the highlight of the game, there was a lot of highlights because it was it was a good Thursday night football game, was Will Hall, the Southern Miss coach, is the son of a legendary Mississippi high school coach. And I got to sit with Coach Hall in the second quarter, and the line of the game by far and away, we're talking about Frank Gore Jr., who's obviously the star young running back for Southern Miss. And Coach Hall said, "That's why Kentucky Derby winners sire Kentucky Derby winners." And his wife looked at him and said, "Are you talking about you and Will?"
Oh, and well, so the question is, was he? Maybe
He was
right?
Talking about the Gores. Yeah. Frank Gore Jr. runs pretty hard. I don't know if we'll see him two decades of Sundays like his dad, but he had a nice little night. Frank Gore Jr. did. And he is a high end Conference USA running back in a really good. He's turned into a really good college football player. That's one of the cool stories in college sports. So anyway, it's a good night. Good night down on the Rock. I enjoyed my side trip to Hattiesburg.
Yeah, and a good Saturday afternoon in Jackson too.
Oh yeah,
to see the way not only the university community but the entire city is supporting Jackson State and taking pride in it. Not only from the crowd at game day, but it was a terrific crowd at the game, even with the threatening weather and their defense. I mean, I know Shadur Sanders ended up getting it going and. And put up some numbers, but their defense is they lead in the statistical categories, but they're fast and they're aggressive and they're sure tacklers, and it's a really good looking unit that Dion has put on the field there.
Well, Dennis Thurman is their defensive coordinator. Mm-hmm. He coordinated in the NFL for nearly a decade. He's an experienced. That was one of the things that impressed me being around their walkthrough on Fridays. Deion Sanders has assembled a very good coaching staff. Tim Brewster, old friend Tim Brewster, from many iterations around FBS college football, former Minnesota head coach, former Fox sideline reporter, in other varied things, is the tight end coach there. And it was an impressive looking team. You walk out on the field, you see them, you're like, okay, they don't look all that different than a Conference USA team. So credit to Deion. He's built a good roster. And I think my takeaway there will just be the spirit that he's instilled. Now, again, it's Jackson State. It's homecoming. People are going to be excited no matter what the record is and what the score is going to be. But I really feel like he's lifted that whole university up. And that was just that will be the feeling when I think back on going to Jackson State 5 years from now, that he has galvanized a university in a city and pushed it forward.
It's one of the things that makes him attractive, I think, for bigger jobs, and when I say bigger, I mean at the highest level of college football and Power Five jobs, because that's part of it now. I think I mentioned this last week that there was a basketball coach at Seth Greenberg's breakfast last week that said, relatively speaking, so little of my day is devoted to just the X's and O's of basketball. And that is true in football too, for a head coach. Now that can't be ignored. I mean, and certainly, Deion Sanders fully capable of doing those things, but part of the role of being the head coach, as opposed to being Dennis Thurman, the defensive coordinator or the offensive coordinator anywhere, is to do what you're talking about, instilling the spirit, overseeing the entire program, dealing with the problems or good moments that any of the players might have on and off the field, setting the tone, the overused phrase, establishing the culture. That's a big deal. That's if a head coach can't do that, rare is the head coach in the college level, maybe the NFL, they can do this, but at the college level, that they can just lock themselves away in the film room and dial up ball plays if they're going to run on Saturday. Can't really do that. And I think that is one of the things, his ability to put together a high-level staff, his ability to generate enthusiasm, his ability to get donors on board. That's one of the things that people will look at as they start to evaluate him. And as I said this in our media availability on Friday, I think the thing about Deion Sanders and whether he will stay or go is that he's Deion Sanders. He doesn't have to go. I think if you're if you're a young coach rising through the ranks, you kind of have to. I mean, you don't have to. No one has to do anything. You can choose to be a high school coach forever. But if you aspire to maybe create wealth for your family generations down the road or whatever it might be, you kind of have to. And Deion's not in that boat. Deion has the ability to do whatever he chooses to do from a professional standpoint. So it was a great trip. We were treated treated wonderfully. One thing that I failed to mention on Saturday, and I'm even reticent to mention it a little bit here because I don't want to, you know, be accused of us tearing rotator cuffs to pat ourselves on the back, meaning speaking corporately as the company. But ESPN, you know, did make a donation, did make a contribution as it pertains to the Jackson water crisis, which seems to be in good shape. But they were a little concerned with, you know, back-to-back big weeks with homecoming last week and rival Southern coming in this week. So, you know, maybe I should have mentioned that on the show Saturday. I didn't, but we're mentioning it here. And, you know, our company, I'm happy to work for a company that's happy to help out in situations like that. So it was a good trip, and we've got a big one coming up to Georgia this week. But let's take a little walk back in terms of establishing. We'll take a brief look over the past weekend. The Michigan State, Michigan thing brought up two problems to me. One is obvious. Can't behave that way. You can be as chippy and resentful as you want to the perceived, big brother type things, being the quote unquote other school in the state. Be as chippy as you want, but it can't devolve into having a fist fight in the tunnel after the game. And really one of that nature where you have a bunch of guys ganging up on one guy. What precipitated it? I don't know. I mean, I'm like everyone else. I'm just looking at the video that I saw of the four Michigan State players that were suspended, and it seemed a few others jumping on one Michigan player. You know, was there taunting? Did it get chippy in the game? Yes. Got to find a way to let it go. I want you to react to that first. But the other thing I'll bring up is the one thing. Last week, we sort of laughed about the tunnel thing and throwing the peanut butter and jelly sandwich and hitting, I think it was RJ Moten in the face when Penn State and Michigan got it. But now we've got 2 weeks in a row an issue in the tunnel. So I'm not saying they have to reconfigure the big house, but they've got to do something. Whatever protocol needs to be established, I think it's just wise, and you get in front of potential problems. If in the post game, now you may have some stuff going to halftime anyway, because everybody has to get in there. But after the game, I don't know if it's winners stay until the losers exit the field. I don't know if it's home team stays until visitors exit the field. There's got to be some way because now it's happened 2 weeks in a row. And you at times it's popped its head up over the years, but mostly it's usually just yelling at each other, which is kind of part of the flavor. But maybe it's time to look into some type of protocol for exiting the field at the big house.
Yeah, it's a pattern now. And the fact that it happened in a pretty high profile way 2 weeks in a row. And administratively, if you're Michigan, you just can't afford to have something else happen. Right. Now, again, I'm not blaming Michigan for what happened. Obviously,
no. I mean, Michigan State's more to blame for this.
Correct.
By the way. No question about that.
Yes. A player got assaulted. Right. Yes. So you can't blame that on a tunnel or allegedly assaulted, I should say. But it's being investigated as an assault. And what happened was unconscionable. I'm glad to see Michigan State take swift action against those players and look into it more. Yeah, I just think like that was one of the ugliest scenes, Reese, that I'd seen in recent memory. On field, in stadium type situations, I can't remember much more. You've essentially got armed men, you know, hitting. You can't even see the Michigan defensive back at some point because he's just surrounded by guys. So that was an ugly day for Michigan State, an ugly moment for Mel Tucker. It's been a bad season on the field, but forget that. All the bad offense and terrible results, those are going to get washed away. This is the one thing Michigan State football will be remembered for this year, more than anything else by far and away. It's an indelible stain, and it's going to be really hard to erase those images and what happened. It was unconscionable, and I'm glad that there's going to be, you know, I'm glad there was swift action and Michigan State's administration took it seriously, but that was just an ugly, ugly night.
It was, and now here's the challenge for Mel Tucker. You know, he was already getting some grief because they weren't winning, and he has the big contract that comes with the territory. Now the challenge is, what kind of program do you want to be? You know, what do you want your reputation to be? How do you want to demand that your players, your staff, everybody behaves? And this is a pivotal moment for the Mel Tucker regime at Michigan State. And it would not have been so without that incident in the tunnel. I'm not talking about the wins and losses. I mean, you know, he's trying to kind of put it together quickly, did it through the portal, tried to do it again over time. I think he'll be able to use the portal more judiciously as opposed to depending on it. But now it becomes a pivotal moment in his regime, not to whether he gets fired, but to what the perception of Michigan State is. Is it going to be that it's this a rough and tumble, chippy, ready for a literal fight, not a figurative one, a figurative fight they should be ready for? They can be a little chippy and edgy in their play within the rules on the field. That's great. In fact, I'm for that, you know, especially for Michigan State with where they are. I'm for that. Figuratively and in terms of intensity on the field. But are you the kind of program that's going to carry it off the field? You know, and then you will be in direct contrast to the program you can't stand, you know, because you don't really see that from Michigan. You never really have. You don't see that from Ohio State. You know, so you aspire to compete with them. Are you going to carry that same level of class and culture within the bounds of behavior once the competition ends? Man, you want to be tough. You want to talk a little smack. You want to knock people on their rear ends on the game during the game. I'm for it, man. I'm here for it. And I think Michigan State does have to have a little bit of an edge because they never will be Michigan or Ohio State. But they can still carry themselves with class. And I do also want to point out when I say this, everybody on the Michigan State team didn't do this. You know, just sure. The four guys who were suspended appeared. Some other ones might have gotten caught up in the moment based on the video clip that I saw. So everybody is not guilty, but everyone gets tainted by it, by having something like that happen within their program. And so it's incumbent on Mel to set the tone, to stop this. And it's also incumbent on the leaders on that team, the players, to not let that happen. I didn't see many players stepping in there to stop that. And that's a problem too, in my judgment. And I hope they get it fixed because I'm, you know, spent a lot of time at Michigan State over the years, both football and basketball. I really like Mel. I think Mel's a good coach. And I think that didn't cast a good light on his program and the understatement of the century there. It didn't. And, you know, and he was aggravated, too, I'm sure. You've probably seen the video by now of the fan reaching out to touch him. He knocks yes. his hand away. Would it have been better maybe not to? Okay. But I don't blame him. I mean, fans, that's you can't do that. I mean, you're not reaching out to, you know, try to get a fist pound or something or shake his hand. You're trying to mess with him. I don't blame him for that.
That was amateur hour by the fan. And yeah, I don't blame that's a human. That's a human interaction. Yeah, that's a human interaction by the like, what are you doing? Don't touch me.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I had a lot of empathy for Mel in that. That was I hope they threw that guy out. I don't know if they did or not. You can't get away with that type of behavior if you're a fan.
I mean, come on, man. You know, reach out and try to mess with somebody like that. You're inviting trouble. You're not part of this. You know, you're part of it by yelling. You know, yell what you want. That's part of the atmosphere. But when you cross that line, that's no good.
Yeah.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes!
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
More fun stuff in Happy Valley. What about JTT, JT Tuimoloau? Okay, let's see. Putting the two into Tuimoloau, two picks, two sacks, tip pass that caused an interception, and two fumble involvements, one fumble forced, one fumble recovered. I mean, that dude was amazing. Yeah, Sean Clifford's going to see him in his nightmares for the rest of his career.
Yeah, it's been interesting with JTT because he came to Ohio State as the number one recruit in the country, not just the top defensive end, but he was regarded as an elite player. Remember, his recruitment, Reese, went right into like May, June. It was a really late spring. It was sort of an unusual timeline as it went. And if I remember right, it was Oregon was right in there. The Buckeyes were obviously in there, and I believe it was Alabama. And so the interesting part of his development, and we've seen this with some of Larry Johnson's elite guys who've come on that defensive line, is that JTT didn't – I mean, he flashed at different times, but he has not – this is the first time you can fairly say that he has dominated a college football game. And Larry Johnson – to his credit, and look, no one can question his methods because of the results he's gotten, doesn't tend to throw guys right into the fire. He rotates a lot of guys. He gives a lot of guys reps. Look, they have very good defensive linemen at Ohio State. And so I think his career had been a little bit of a slow burn build up to this moment. But boy, once he got unleashed, it's going to be hard to not play him a lot more snaps now. Just as you go forward and move forward here, Zach Harrison's had a nice season for Ohio State on that defensive line. He was another highly regarded recruit, and he hasn't quite lived up to what he was supposed to be in recruiting, but it's nice to see a guy come in, maybe struggle a little, endure, and then flash now in his fourth season. And we started to see some flashes of Jack Sawyer, who's the other defensive end who was regarded as the top. Those guys were basically the top D end recruits in the country. And when you look at the line of Bosa's and Chase Young's who've gone through there, certainly the Buckeyes have cornered the market in some ways on the elite high end defensive ends. But yeah, JTT was a freakazoid. Some people said it was the most dominant defensive line performance they've ever seen. Boy, I have a couple Chase Young games in the back of my mind where he absolutely wrecked games in the same way JTT did. So certainly a high-end, unbelievably dominating. If Urban Meyer was the coach, he definitely would have called it the best game ever by a Buckeye defensive end because nobody loved hyperbole more than Urban. You know, he'd be like, that's the best practice by a redshirt, best spring practice eight by a redshirt sophomore left guard that we've ever seen here at Ohio.
That I've ever been associated with.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Urban loved some hyperbole. It made him, always made him good to cover because you're like, oh, that's a great quote.
Well, I think the thing that got people were the interceptions by the defensive end, having a couple of them and the touchdown for sure. Weekend Review is brought to you by Eckrich Smoked Sausage. Find them in the refrigerated meat aisle at your favorite grocery store to create one-of-a-kind sausage recipes. Eckrich, you do you. So what did you leave that game with as it pertains to Ohio State? You know, I sort of think that I came out of it thinking that even when they were struggling and the offense wasn't clicking exactly, that it seemed so much easier for them than it did for Penn State as they tried to move the ball. And that's a credit to JTT and the entire defense. But it was notable to me that it just seemed easy even when it wasn't clicking for Ohio State because of their vast array of talent.
Yeah, I think that, you know, as we've looked at, it's funny to look at the stats because they actually had less yards than Penn State, less first downs than Penn State. Now, some of that was Penn State, you know, they had such short fields from JTT that they didn't maybe have to, they didn't have to drive the length of the field a bunch of times. But there were some three and outs. There were some moments of learning and struggle. One of the interesting things to me that I thought might have been instructive early in the game was Ohio State struggled to run the ball. Now, credit to that offensive line and credit to Cade Stover. He was a monster blocking in the run game for Ohio State. We've talked about him here on the pod and what a difference he's made giving that Ohio State offense an edge. There was one of those Travion Henderson runs that he blocked two guys and mauled them through. So without early results, Ohio State stuck enough to the run where Travion Henderson was able to end up gashing Penn State late. But I thought some of the early struggles to run the ball were, you know, were pretty interesting. Ohio State only ended up with 3.8 yards a rush, and that was with a couple of late chunk plays that kind of came through there. So I by no means at this point does anyone think, you know, Ohio State's going to do to Michigan in Ohio Stadium what the Don Brown defenses, what happened to the Don Brown defenses there for a couple of years in a row where Ohio mm-hmm. State just flummoxed them on offense. I just think that game, to me, after this Penn State game, that Ohio State-Michigan game is going to be a rock fight. It is going to be a test of wills. I do think that Ohio State showing a little bit more bones defensively at times this year is going to be helpful to them. I do think some of the schematic stuff that Jim Knowles has brought to them has started to flash at, you know, different times. But those battles in the trenches in Ohio State, Michigan on what we're probably hoping is going to be a cold, snowy, you know, November sort of Big Ten weather game. I think it's going to be a very interesting fist fight that Ohio State's probably better prepared for, but by no means can you just say, oh, they're gonna TKO them in the third round.
No, I agree. I think maybe, you know, you're right. I think I was so influenced by, like, when Ohio State had its back to the wall, the three play 75-yard touchdown drive. And then the one that followed was seven plays, 75 yards. I'm just looking at the drive chart here. They went 16-yard completion, 12-yard completion, 42-yard completion, 7-yard touchdown. You know, and those are just the highlight plays. I was like, boom, boom, boom. And to be able to pull that out when they needed it most, I think is, probably something that very few teams, maybe Tennessee, you know, can pull out drives like that when they need them. But we'll probably find out whether the Big Orange can do that against Georgia on the road, as Ohio State did it in a hostile road environment on Saturday. Couple more things from the weekend. You texted me during the stunning demolition by Kansas State of Oklahoma State. Not stunning that they won, stunning that they beat them 48-0, that – you know, for
Gundy's worst loss, right, Reese?
Yeah, Gundy's worst loss. I think their first shutout since, I might get this wrong, memory, I think like 09, maybe something. Been a really long time. But I think you sent me a text and said maybe Will Howard is their best quarterback, best option.
Well, you know, certainly he put on a first half performance against TCU, and he got a little banged up in the second half there and missed a possession at TCU. But my gosh, what a revelatory performance. I believe they were up 35-0 at halftime. And, you know, I can't sit here and tell you I've watched every snap of K-State this year to have like a great Howard versus Martinez feel. But I do think if you're that offensive coaching staff and you're Colin Klein and you're going back there on Monday, You've got to ask yourself, okay, going forward here, who gives us the best chance to win? Because Howard's a guy who came there from California, I believe, and you know was regarded as a good recruit. But the thought in camp this summer was that he just needed a little time and seasoning, which quarterbacks do. Not all quarterbacks are ready made. From the sounds of talking to people about the Adrian Martinez injury. You know, he was close to being able to go. He practiced limited on Thursday. With Texas coming to town this weekend, you would think that leg would be, okay to be back. But I just think, boy, what a, you know, I guess it's an enviable position in a lot of ways because Adrian Martinez has had a heck of a year. I think he's the only starter in the country to have not thrown an interception yet. And again, I don't know what you want to use for attempts and whatnot, but the only guy who started here as a starter pretty much played every game who hasn't thrown an interception. I think he's responsible for 13 touchdowns and no interceptions. And he's a man, right? He's been through it all. You know, there's a lot of positives that come with that. But You know, look, Will Howard was special. He had 296 passing yards. There were a couple big shot chunk plays that looked pretty good. Put a smile on my face to see Cade Warner, son of Kurt, mm-hmm. on the receiving end of two of those. Like, what a perfect place for a Warner kid to go. K-State, you know, the gritty, you know, overachieving program of the last couple generations. And, you know, does the threat of that pass game, you know, especially downfield, make Deuce Bond even more lethal? So I don't know. What do you think, Reese? Do you make that switch here?
No, I don't. But I like the fact that I think it seems to have made them more dynamic in the passing game. And it's a credit to Colin Klein and to the entire structure of the offense that they can change things a little bit. I think Martinez has established himself as a leader. And as you mentioned, he's had a great season. He's a great runner. And that has, you know, has made their rushing attack lethal, extra blocker, all of those things that coaches who run quarterbacks like. But what happens is when you run the quarterback that often is you're susceptible to a sprained ankle or to a, you know, banged up shoulder. And you know for a fact now that you have – and look, Will's played some in the past, probably thrown into the fire well before he was ready in years past. But now you know – he can deliver, which now means that Adrian Martinez can just go play. I think he's capable of throwing the ball too, but they, you know, Will Howard can run. He's not as dynamic as Martinez running. So I don't make the switch, but you know, you've got someone at the ready should things falter, or should Adrian not be 100%, you know, should he not, you know, should the ankle act up again or some such thing, which you certainly hope it doesn't. But, you know, they strike me as the type of program where it's not a quarterback controversy as it would be almost anywhere else. But given Adrian's path to get to Kansas State and Will's patience, you know, and knowing is sort of like you were talking about the gritty, scrappy program, anywhere else you might have some hurt feelings and agitation. I'm betting that's not the case in Manhattan. And it's a really, really big game for them Saturday and a big game for Texas, because you lose that game and the best you can do is another mediocre season for Texas.
Yes. And I have not talked to anybody at K-State as we tape this on Monday morning, but I would guess that they're not going to tip their hand on who they're going to start. Because now if your Texas is defense is staff, you've got to prepare for two kind of totally different players, which is just mm-hmm. a pain in the, you know, pain in the rear. So Chris Klein has won a lot of football games. So yeah. I don't think he needs any help, you know, in sort of confusing and making the opponent inefficient in their preparation. Now, I also think if Adrian Martinez starts, and to no fault of his own, they're down 14-0 quick. You have someone who has shown, I mean, he had Will Howard had four consecutive touchdown drives at TCU. Some of the TCU staff said to me that they thought Howard was just the better player. So that was sort of where that got planted in the back of my mind. I got a couple of texts about that late in the week as we were talking about, you know, who, mm-hmm. you know, is Adrian Martinez going to start, was one of the bigger stories. We talked about a bunch on game day on Saturday. So there were a few people who just kind of volunteered to me like, ooh, they might be better off with Howard. And not that the thought hadn't crossed my mind because he was so dynamic in that first half, but it certainly is that there's a little bit of wow. I mean, the best news for Kansas State going forward is he's a third-year player who I believe would wrap into the COVID year. I don't know what year anyone is anymore, Reese. But like, but he's got a couple of years left and, you know, pretty high ceiling going forward. So that's a nice piece to have, knowing as a coaching staff and the piece is with peace of mind. Okay, we don't have to go get another veteran guy in the portal. We have a guy on campus. We can focus on developing our younger guys and keeping them rolling. But on Texas, whew, that would be, I think the number is that Sark is, Texas had a bye last week, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So they were 10-10. In Sark's first 20 games. And I think it took Tom Herman till his 27th game to lose 10 games. Now, comparing coaching reigns, it's like, well, he left us with great players like Bijan Robinson. He left us with bad players on the offensive line. You can parse it any way you want. But the reality is that Sark needs to start winning because they are not patient there. I really thought that him having to apologize for the eyes of Texas thing, like, Now, Texas football may be sputtering and Texas football may be underachieving, but they will always lead the nation in self-importance in trotting their coach out to apologize for the eyes of Texas. I'm sorry. Like, I just thought that was like, it was just like, why is Texas football like broken from the top down? I thought that was like a perfect snapshot of that. They hamstrung Herman with that for weeks and weeks on end. And I don't think Sark like was like, I'm going to go do this. I have no inside knowledge of that, but that's not exactly how coaches are wired. They're wired like, man, we just lost a heck of a competitive game. We're heartbroken. I plumb forgot. Like, you don't have to start your press conference with a public apology. That's the people at Texas, the suits, the puppeteers and danglers taking themselves way too seriously.
I totally agree. You want to answer a question about it and answer it honestly, go ahead. You know, but otherwise, I mean, they just lost a really, really difficult game. One thing that popped in my mind when you said you don't know how many years anyone has left anymore, what class they are. Probably the most stunning piece of information that I've come across in the last few weeks is when we were at Oregon. I had no idea that Bo Nix had another year if he chooses to use it. Bo Nix can come back next year if he wants.
I didn't know that either.
I was like, wait, what? Really? And he's got another year.
I guess we should tell our listeners, everybody now has six if you were on campus for the COVID year.
Right. So like 2020 didn't count, no matter who you are.
So you can be a redshirt freshman with four remaining. But there's also plenty of guys who've also gotten injury exemptions who are, you know, in their seventh year right now. And I think there's even one or two like going on eight. So anyway, it's not like we're lazy and can't look it up. But when someone says something is a freshman, that can mean like three different things. So it's just I've started to try to write like third year player. But now when it's going to get really confusing is some of the younger players who've come in 21 and don't have the COVID exemption are now back to being 5 year guys. So it's like. He's a third year player with a 6 year window as opposed to that. So yes, it's all confusing. I was happy for you, Reese, that when Troy played on Thursday, it was the Thursday we were going out to Eugene, that your guy Jared Daigie got a start for the Detroit Trojans. He's going to win too on Thursday night. I know he's one of your favorite vagabonds who's around to quite a few places. I think Bowling Green, West Virginia, where he started for 2 years, Western Kentucky. For like a week of summer school. And then he went to the BW3s in Bowling Green for like 15 minutes. And then he's now in Troy, Alabama. So,
on the subject of Troy, you know, they beat South Alabama, whose only other loss was to UCLA in the last minute. So
on an awful, awful fake field goal call.
Right.
Just a terrible call. I'm sorry. That was one of the worst play calls of the entire college football
season. Dumb loses more than smart wins.
That was dumb. That was if you had to rate the dumb loses more than smart wins, that would be like the Jim Carrey of the dumb loses more than smart wins.
So on Saturday, I decided and this turned out to be a horrible 50-50 choice. I've put it out on Twitter. Should I take North Texas and the 10 against Western Kentucky, or should I take Arkansas State at home getting 9 against South Alabama, right? So I chose poorly, unwisely. I had a gut feeling about North Texas, but then I said so many home teams have won this year and you're getting close to 10, maybe Arkansas State to keep it close, dead wrong. South Alabama blows them out, right? So I get this text from an unnamed person at South Alabama that said, it was suggested to me that I send you a weird number one emoji, but minus the index finger. So you know what my response was? It was two things. It was like, you know what? I think I was the first to put you in the top 25 this year and you freaking lost to Troy. And by the way, I missed all your thank you notes for ranking you in the top 25. Mute text person. So I hope it was
Major Applewhite who has the wit to be able to write something now.
But you know, the one thing after I had done that, I thought, you know what? And it's why I rarely respond and never do it. Well, I say never, 0.1% of the time on social media. Because the one thing in the aftermath, because it did annoy me, not so much that they were having fun, but just the tone of it. And I thought, well, what if the person was trying to be funny? Didn't come across that way. You know, I was like, well, it'd be different. And to be clear, I don't have like some deep relationship with this person. It was almost like a random text. I wasn't really sure how he got my number to begin with. And anyway, it struck me as obnoxious. So I reached into my Bill Raftery bag. Raft always used to say that when, you know, some coach would come over and complain about some criticism or something. And Raft would go, I must have missed all your thank you notes for the good stuff I said. So I just reached into the Raftery bag of tricks and then muted the conversation. Whoever the person is, I hope he doesn't need anything else because it's not coming through to my phone anymore. Anyway, and he listens to the podcast, so he'll know that now. You'll have to reach out through a secondary party. After that, Hypnotoad does it again.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea, maybe the anecdote for the patented Sonny Dykes fade. I don't know, we're just getting in November, so we'll see. Maybe it's Hypnotoad.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Don't toads have like some weird medicinal values in like some sort of in some sort of cultures? Am I completely wrong in saying that? Is that like my bad Halloween hex of something? I certainly barely know anything about college football, so I certainly don't know anything about pharmaceuticals. So,
well, I know that if your dog catches a toad and licks it, it'll start foaming at the mouth like it's got rabies. So you have to be careful with that.
Okay. Yeah. Toads are funny. Yeah. Toads are funny. Maybe this is it. Maybe the Hypnotoad combined with Halloween. Where do you think they're ranked Tuesday, Reese? We're taping this on Monday.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting question. I think they're the most interesting of anyone because where they start will determine where they have to go and how much traffic is going to be in front of them.
Probably where they are in the poll, I think. I think they'll probably be 7. I could see them being ranked ahead of Alabama and maybe being 6. I don't worry as much about the traffic in front of them because I think it'll take care of themselves. I think it'll move. They'll move up as long as they stay unbeaten. What might not be what might be tougher. I was about to say might not be fair, but it might very well be fair because I think the committee should employ some football judgment in evaluating the teams. But what might be tougher for them from a starting point is if they were to lose a game but still win the Big 12 championship, then that might put them in peril against, you know, if there is a one-loss SEC team that's not the conference champion. So, you know, I think that's interesting for sure. But I think 6 or 7 is where I anticipate them being. You know, look, here's the other thing. They could be 6 still behind Alabama, but in front of Clemson. That wouldn't stun me. If how those teams stack up in that group.
I also think they played two road games out of league. Now look, Colorado stinks, but when you schedule that 5 years ago, you don't know Colorado's going to stink. And you go play at SMU, like that's a good salty little road game against a team that's been, you know, consistently solid the last 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a rivalry game that they traditionally play. But, you know, so you go there, you look through their schedule and then you see 1, 2, 3, 4 top 20 wins in a row. And then they look like they weren't going to go to West Virginia and win 42-7. We knew that they. Mm-hmm. You know, they won as, you know, that's a road win in the league. And if you do that by double digits,
it's a great win.
It's a great win. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I have no issues with that. The interesting thing about them going forward and why I'm so concerned with where they start being ranked is they will not play another ranked team. Now, maybe Baylor could be ranked on November 19th. And I give Dave Aranda credit. They're rounding into form as we've, you know, as we've seen them do over the years. But I really think that all of a sudden, you could have 4 games against. Now, look, is it easy to go to Texas and win or Baylor to win? No, it's not. Like Texas still has Bijan Robinson, who's a top 5 prospect. Quinn Ewers can still spin it. It's a difficult place to play. So I don't think anyone, if Texas is sputtering near 500 at that time, which they inevitably will be just because of the amount of losses they have already. But like it could be held against them that they are not, they don't have any ranked teams left. So I, that's why I just think an early pole position where you're established and where you have to go. I do agree. If they are an undefeated Big 12 conference champion, they will go to the college football playoff. But the one loss, and look, do I think they'll probably trip up in the next four games? Yes, it's college football. You have two hard road games. And, you know, look, they got to play Iowa State at home, and Iowa State can drag you into the mud, even though they're winless in the league. And Texas Tech has shown enough flashes where you're just certainly not going to write that off as a win. And quite frankly, TCU's shown the vulnerabilities to get behind where this isn't some version of 2020 Alabama. So anyway, they're interesting. I am so glad TCU has just sort of become this fascinating high-end team this year, because I think it's really spiced up the sport, spiced up the conversation. It's good to have, with Oklahoma, Texas ailing, it's good to have that region with some vibrancy and some relevancy. And it's exciting that for the Big 12 going forward, and we should probably talk a little bit about their TV contract, because I do think in the big picture of college sports, that's something that's pretty important that, you know, that unfolded on Sunday there. But I do think just having TCU as a flagship for the Big 12 going forward is important.
And wow, I mean, even before we expand the playoff, there are new teams getting involved. Who could have ever imagined that college football doesn't stay the same forever and ever? What a stunner. TCU, Tennessee, you know, in the mix here. What do I know?
What did you think, Reese, when you saw the Big 12 TV deal come down yesterday?
It looked like it put them in a really strong position in terms of staying among the upper echelon of conferences. They're not going to be the SEC or the Big Ten, but it showed there's some power in markets. I think with you know, you've got the Orlando market, you've got Cincinnati market, Dallas market, you know. So, I mean, you follow that very closely. Would you have imagined that they would have come up with a deal like this when it was announced that Oklahoma and Texas were headed to the SEC?
I guess from that moment to now, I'm surprised they've gotten as much money as they have. They have, you know, they have basically are going to get to start 7 or 8 million more per school on the, or maybe a little bit more than that, because it's going to go from 22 million pure media to about 32 million, 31 and a half, something like that. So there's always two numbers in this, which is why reporting on this is can be a little bit dizzying, because there's two sets of numbers. There's the actual media number, and then there's the total number, which is college football playoff number, units from the NCAA tournament, bowls, et cetera. There's an extra pot. So their pure media number starting in 26 when this deal starts is going to be nearly 32 million. And then with all the other stuff that comes with it, their number is going to go from 42 to somewhere in the low, probably the low 50s, at least 50 million. So that's, I think, if you had dropped that offer sheet in front of the remaining Big 12 ADs, and they obviously added four schools, they would have sprinted to sign that deal. I think the happiest campuses on Sunday were at UCF, Cincinnati, Houston, and BYU, because that is a truckload more money annually than you're getting both media and total, like a truckload more money. So, you know, that's pure media wise, that's 4X, 5X. That's a lot of money. So I think the important nuance going forward, look, these things come out, there's a lot of spin and everything of like, we're the best and we're going to outpace everybody. And then everyone's like, no, the Pac-12 is going to get this monster deal. And I think the reality is that these two leagues value wise were always probably in the same neighborhood. And Yormark did two things. One, he just got a deal done and solidified it at a really good number. So that's important because there's stability. There's a grant of rights involved, which is hugely important for the leagues going forward. It's also on ESPN and Fox, and it's not on streaming, which generally now for this next, I guess it's going to be 8-year term, I think there's a good visibility sell there. Do I think this turns into some massive like domino for realignment? No, I don't. I think that if any school is thinking of leaving the Pac-12, they now just know what the cards are, right? Mm-hmm. Like they can say, okay, here's what the value would be there. Here's what the distribution would be there. And here's where we're going to be seen. institutionally, in the Big Ten had a chance to go with Amazon during its deal. And institutionally, the presidents were kind of like, for that B package, like, well, let's just go with, you know, let's just go with NBC and CBS. Those are safe. Those are safer. We're not going to have fans calling us. We're not going to like rile up our fan bases. So obviously part of the Pac-12's future is going to be a streaming play for them to get a television deal. And with that streaming play is going to come some pushback. Just like you've been at ESPN long enough, you probably remember when people pushed back when Carolina Duke was on ESPN 2, right? Like there's always been these evolutions. Ohio State fans were irate that the Big Ten Network showed their Youngstown game when that started. That was a whole thing. So we've gone through these, oh my gosh, scary change, and then scary change becomes normal. And I think that's what the Pac-12 is going to be facing. How much money they're going to get, that's interesting, right? Could be a little more, could be a little less. I don't think anyone can say definitively, but I do think just inherently there's some money off the table. So I'm sure there's some sweaty palms out west today.
I think that whatever, a couple things, whatever money the Pac-12 ends up getting, perhaps they could invest into officiating, or at least
Mike Bone agrees with you, Reese.
The perception of officiating, or perhaps streaming some of those games on, I don't know, Pluto TV or something like that would be a really, really good job, because dumb loses more than smart wins didn't exactly make anybody lose. But if you saw the end of the first half of the USC Arizona game, the officiating handling of the end of half clock situation was ridiculous. It was preposterous, and it fed the narrative, which I'm sure is not always, in fact, I know it's not always accurate, that, you know, Pac-12 is deficient in officiating somehow. But man, when there's a gaffe, it is gargantuan. If you don't know the situation, tight game in the first half with SC in Arizona. I think SC was up by 4. They don't have any timeouts. They're trying to get down the field to get another score on the board. Looked like at the beginning of the play with about 15 seconds left that they probably try to get it in field goal range and spike it. It ends up that Caleb Williams scrambles to his right, fires the ball down the field to Rice, and now they're inside the 10, but they still need to spike the thing. But the clock stops on a first down. Now, he caught it right around the 6 or 5 second mark. So that's plenty of time, because the ball is not, the clock is not wound again until the ball is put into play. They get the offense to the line. People are lined up, and the official hasn't spotted the ball yet, and the clock starts running. And then by the time he puts it down, the clock has expired. Lincoln Riley's going wild on the sideline, rightfully so. They talked about it for a minute. The officials did. And inexplicably just came on and said, half's over. Like, what?
AD went ballistic on Twitter. I don't know if you saw that. And this is a great league office conundrum. If a guy goes ballistic on Twitter and it's justified against the officials, do you still publicly recommend him and fine him when the inadequacy he was pointing out was so egregious that it deserved the criticism?
Well, he probably will, because he's going to the Big Ten. So go ahead. You can
go ahead and reprimand. Oh, good point. I didn't think about that. It'd probably fine him double.
Yeah. Some of the Big Ten money and just try to really, really
stick
it to
him. Maybe they'll fine him so much that George Klyavkov will say USC is going to lose money, just like he keeps saying UCLA is going to lose money when they go forward, which is one of the more suspect like tropes I've ever seen a commissioner keep trotting out to sad trombones, because he spent his media day like distracting for basketball, distracting from their very good basketball media by trotting out suspect numbers. That if it was a political race, I think the fact checkers would have shot those down pretty quickly. But
well,
anyway, I digress.
Never mind. Yeah. Well, no, if I was, never mind. I won't say that what I was thinking, but anyway, the officials fell into the trap of dumb loses more than smart wins, because the smart thing to do and the smart play would have been to say, this is going to be embarrassing, but let's fix this. Instead, they're like, yeah, let's just get out of here and go to halftime. And, you know, really, really bad look. It ended up, look, it didn't matter in the long term, because USC won the game, but really, really bad look at the end of the half. Or maybe, I don't know. Maybe it was a parting shot at SC from Arizona for going to the Big Ten. Who knows? Arizona.
Does that Pac-12 officiating paper. Twitter handle still exist? The one with the glasses? That's like a mock, Twitter.
Probably at Oregon.
Yeah. Oh, that was funny.
Yeah, there were people dressed in early Halloween costumes as Pac-12 officials, and you can probably imagine that they were questioning just how good the eyesight was. The costumes were.
They really sold it. That was aggressive.
Yeah.
It was very aggressive. Row too. They weren't subtle. They weren't in like row 17, section H. They were like right there behind the UCLA bench.
Yeah. Dressed as officials. And I'm just not sure what I'm allowed to say anymore about that, but you can imagine they were questioning the validity of their ability to see. And if they were, by definition, a Pac-12 official. The funniest thing was the hat hadn't really been made up. It was just like, somebody, they just written like Pac-12, on a piece of paper and stuck it to the front of their hat, which is.
It's like those old fedoras that say press.
Yeah, exactly. Are you a Three Stooges guy?
I'm not.
See, I love the Three Stooges. Three Stooges were sneaking into, I think, a horse race once, and they were wearing the fedora. And Mo comes through and it says press. He goes, press. And Larry comes through and press and press. And then Curly behind him has one that says pull. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then he sneaks in. And of course, they chase him and hilarity ensues. Would you let Teddy watch the Three Stooges? I really think you should.
He's pretty hardcore on Elmo, as we talked about before. His fidelity to Elmo is pretty unmatched. We're getting to the point when we turn it off, he starts to get a little mad, and that's probably why all the experts say he shouldn't be watching Elmo. But that's okay. He loves it. Makes him happy.
Yeah. Who do you think is going to be number one when the rankings come out? I've got a sneaking suspicion. Well, the football guys are going to like Georgia, not just because they won it last year, but because of the completeness of the team. But the resume is going to really tilt to Tennessee. I think Ohio State people are going to be really mad because I think they're going to be number three.
So is it who should be number one or who?
No, this is a who do you think? I still have Ohio State number one. I'm saying who do you suspect the committee will place 1-2 tomorrow night?
I suspect they're going to place Tennessee number one.
I do too.
I suspect it because the body of work they have the. Throw down the gauntlet victory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Ohio State has two very good victories, but they don't have Notre Dame sort of flailing for a little bit and give them credit. They have come back and that will end up looking like a top 25-ish victory, I think, by the end of the season. But it's not in the same universe as scoring half a hundred on Alabama. Mm-hmm. So I just think that's going to resonate. And look, they went to Pitt and won an overtime game. That's the defending ACC champion. They actually didn't play in the fourth quarter against North Carolina on Saturday night, Pitt. But they're, you know, it's a good program. So I really think that Tennessee, and I think the tenor of the Kentucky victory is also going to impress the committee. That's a real win to win in that fashion, and that shows a little bit of some of the balance. Watching that broadcast, Herbie and Fowler kept bringing up Tennessee's 130th ranked pass defense, and I do think some of those numbers come from they're ahead by so much. Teams have to throw on them to come. You just can't run the clock on Tennessee when they're up 21-0 in a blink. So I think my opinion on how it plays out. I think we go Tennessee, Georgia, Ohio State. I think Buckeye fans are mad. I also think like these rankings don't really matter. And, having one versus two is probably good for the sport on Saturday, just in general. And I think the stewards know that a little bit, like if they can juice things up, and one versus two gets everybody pretty giddy. So, yeah, and I understand why the pollsters have Tennessee 3. It's a mixed bag. It's going to sort itself out in the, Ohio State has its game and Tennessee and Georgia have their games. And then whoever wins that game is going to have another game, we can assume. So there can be a lot of jousting over this stuff. If Ohio State's number one, am I going to flinch? No, they're good. They still may be the most complete team in the country. That has shown that so far. Look, Georgia's really good. So I think any of those three, none of them would cause me to flinch. I do like that there's a little bit of actual drama going into the first show.
I do too. I this was the closest I had come to putting Tennessee number one this week. And I am more skeptical of Kentucky than okay. others. Not that I don't think they're good. I think they have some offensive line deficiencies. I think a lot is put on Levis. I never believed that they were a threat to Tennessee. I'll just be candid about that. And I just didn't think they could keep up. But now 44-6 was a little bit more than I anticipated.
That game was 45-42 last year.
Yeah.
So it's in Lexington, but that, credit Tim Banks, the defense. It is not easy to be a defensive coordinator on the other side of that system. Like there weren't a whole lot of Baylor defensive coordinators under Art Briles who went and got jobs, right? The list of so-called Baylor offense DCs who've gone on and thrived is, could be fit on a fortune cookie. So credit them for hanging on and figuring it out and kind of running the sort of aggressive boom bust turnover, forcing style that is, that has allowed them to just stay in line with that system. But you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable as a DC in those systems.
I think we're going to get 1-2 on Saturday. And oddly enough, for a couple of programs who have some history for sure, and Georgia is perhaps embarking on its best period, that remains to be seen. But neither of them have ever played in a regular season 1-2 game.
Wow.
So this will be a first. This is new blood in the so-called games of the century, or games of the year, the decade, whatever you want to call it. So you have some new blood in there for that with Georgia and Tennessee playing. And, Georgia has really been underappreciated. Georgia has the benefit of having gone to school somewhat, although they're not carbon copies of Alabama stylistically on defense, but they do have the advantage of having gone to school and said, we better not do that. We better not get ourselves in a position where a safety is locked up on Jalen Hyatt. That would not be a good idea. Let's say we don't do that. And so they'll have some benefits in terms of doing it. Now, whether they can do anything about it remains to be seen. And I also think that Georgia has been a little bit underappreciated this year because of the way the schedule went. They brought some of it on themselves, a couple of sleepy performances, but they crush Oregon, which, by the way, is going to be a really high-level victory when the rankings come out, too, and will probably justify Georgia being 2, if not 1. So they'll have that. But it's almost as if we've just conceded everything, that Tennessee is 2019 LSU, and that Georgia at home is going to come up short against this offensive juggernaut the way Alabama did against Joe Burrow and LSU. And poor old Georgia, that was a nice little win you had last year to take the national championship, but it's Tennessee's time. And
Georgia's a 7.5-point favorite. And somebody told me it opened in the double digits.
No, I think there's a vibe. I think there's a vibe that a lot of people are really expecting Tennessee, regardless of what the line says. I know. Who you think I'm talking about?
That's fine. If I'm setting vibes, we'll talk.
I don't think we'll break down that game
in full in our midweek pod, because I've talked to people who have played both teams and they have opinions.
Yes, they do.
And those opinions do not include Georgia suffocating Tennessee and beating them 10-7.
No, they won't do that. They won't have to. I mean, poor old Stetson Bennett. We made him a hero for a day and a half, and now
could we have a ribeye side bet going here? I feel a little tension brewing.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe I'm just overly influenced because every time Tennessee and Georgia play, I want to say one thing about this too. This is a weird, I don't even call it a rivalry, because I think there's going to be a tendency Saturday to try to make this into something. They've got some weird moments here and there that are memorable, but this is not deep seated rivalry. Georgia even stupidly and oddly rushed the field in 2000 after they'd beaten them in 12 years. Georgia, what are you doing? You know, but anyway, that won't happen Saturday if Georgia wins the game, nor should it. So it's not going to be like the cathartic, you know, victory because Georgia's owned them lately. But what I always think of when I think of Georgia-Tennessee, two things. I think of Herschel putting Bill Bates on the hood when they went on to win the national championship that year. And then, of course, I think of touchdown! Touchdown! My God, a touchdown! Did you see what he did? Well, of course they didn't, because Uncle Larry, because it was on the radio. David Green just straightened up, and we snuck the fullback over. We just stepped on their face with a hobnailed boot and broke their nose. We just crushed their face.
That's unbelievable.
The great Larry Munson.
That is unbelievable.
Pete, we're getting – I love Larry Munson. Larry Munson because – he was.
Could you hear him in Alabama growing up?
For sure. I was listening the night that Herschel ran over Bill Bates. Listening on an old Grundig radio. So it was a big freestanding thing, which could get stations.
After you walked uphill to school both ways.
Yeah, exactly. So I was listening. That's what you see how exciting I was on Saturday nights. I was spending the night listening to radio. I was listening to the game when Herschel did that, because nowadays that would be on television, but 1980, you know, for when a 14-year-old Reese Davis, that was not on, it was not on television yet. So Anyway, I think about that. And then of course, Tennessee fans would love the Dobnail boot from 2016 with Joshua Dobbs Hail Mary. So, you know, it's a rivalry, if you want to call it that, that has had moments that are memorable, but it hasn't continuously been the theme because Georgia hates Florida way more. They have a, you know, deep-seated rivalry with Auburn. It's more important. Even keeping Georgia Tech at bay is probably a little more important. And weirdly, they really can't stand Clemson because of proximity, even though they don't play that often. So,
mostly because Clemson got Trevor Lawrence, I think.
Yeah, probably so. So, you know, it's like Tennessee falls like fifth. But Saturday, it's number one. And how about this? Final parting shot, Georgia-Tennessee, which you said we'll break down on Wednesday, and we will. Georgia-Tennessee has relegated Alabama-LSU to the after party. Meh. And they've relegated Florida State-Miami to afterthought. I'll bet a lot of people don't even realize they're playing. I mean, I have 1-2 in the regular season, and Florida State and Miami play Saturday.
Wow. That's the beauty of college football. It is not just the same movie.
We are going to now let Pete go search for his Halloween costume to greet all of the trick-or-treaters in the greater Boston area as they come by for the sweets that Pete does not care for. We'll break down Georgia-Tennessee. Look ahead to all of the other games on Wednesday. And, of course, picks coming up on Friday. Great weekend from College Game Day at Jackson. And we thank you for listening to the podcast. Download it wherever it is that you prefer to get your podcast. We're here 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Pete, I'm Reese. See you later.